This episode is brought to you by FX's The Veil, starring Elizabeth Moss. FX's The Veil is an international spy thriller that follows two women as they play a deadly game of truth and lies on the road from Istanbul to Paris and London. One woman has a secret, and the other has a mission to reveal it before thousands of lives are lost. FX's The Veil premieres April 30th, only on Hulu.
Hello, everybody. This is Marshall Poe. I'm the founder and editor of the New Books Network. I've published several academic books, and one of the things I found frustrating is my inability to get them picked up in the press. There really is no PR service specifically oriented toward academic books. Recently, however, I had the opportunity to work with a PR firm in New York, RLM, on a book that I recently published. And I have to say, they did a remarkable job at a very low price. And this got me thinking. I wonder if the New Books Network and RLM could provide a service that would promote academic books. So the folks at RLM and I put our heads together and we came up with a package. It is specifically targeted toward people like you, people who write academic books. So if you're interested, you should go to the NBN website and click publish your book, and there you'll find some information about the services that the NBN and RLM are offering. What we really want to do is provide you with value for money. As far as we know, no such service exists. This is the first of its kind, and we really hope it is successful, and we hope that it helps you get the word out about your academic book.
Welcome to the New Books Network.
Hello, everyone, and welcome back to the New Books in East Asian Studies, a podcast channel on the New Books Network. I'm Liping Chen, your host for today's episode. Today, we will be talking to Dr. Zhong Ping Chen about his new book, Trans-Pacific Reform and Revolution, The Chinese in North America, 1898 to 1918. This book was published by Stanford University Press in 2023. The late 19th and early 20th centuries saw the turbulent end of China's imperial system, violent revolutionary movements, and the fraught establishment of a republican government. During these decades of reform and revolution, millions of far-flung overseas Chinese remained connected to Chinese domestic movements. This book uses rich archival sources and a network analysis approach to examine how reform and revolution in North American Chinatowns influenced political change in China, as well as the Trans-Pacific Chinese diaspora from 1898 to 1918. Historian Zhong Pingchen focuses on the transnational activities of Kang Youwei, Sun Yat-sen, and other politicians, especially their mobilization of the Chinese in North America to join reformist and revolutionary parties in patriotic fights for a Western-style constitutional monarchy or for a republic in China. These new reformist and revolutionary parties, including the first Chinese women's political organization, led Trans-Pacific movements against American anti-Chinese racism in 1905 and supported constitutional reform and the Republican Revolution in China around 1911, achieving Trans-Pacific expansion through innovative use of cross-cultural political ideologies as well as intertwined institutional and interpersonal networks. Through network analysis of the origins, interrelations, and influences of Chinese reform and revolution in North America, this book makes a significant contribution to modern Chinese history, Asian American and Asian Canadian history, as well as Chinese diaspora scholarship. So this is a brief introduction about the book. Now let's hear from the author. Dr. Chen, welcome to the show.
Thank you.
So, Dr. Chen, before we talk about your amazing new books, can you tell us a little bit about yourself, your affiliation, research interest, or anything you would like us to know?
I'm a professor of Chinese history and the history of global Chinese diaspora at the University of Victoria in Western Canada. I have research interests in socioeconomic history or later Imperial China, or the Chinese history in the Ming and Qing dynasties from 1368 to 1912, and the global history of Chinese diaspora, especially the overseas Chinese history in North America. Recently, I have developed a new research interest in the environmental history of China during the so-called Little Ice Age from 1400 to 1900. My publications include six books and more than 60 journal articles in English and Chinese, as well as my works on two websites. My six books include two English monographs. First one, Modern China's Network Revolution, that was published by Stanford University Press in 2011. And the newly released book, Trans-Pacific Reform and the Revolution, The Chinese in North America, which was also published by Stanford University Press in 2023. I also published one Chinese biography of a national hero of Ming China, called Yu Qian. Yu Qian saved China from the second wave of Mongol invasion in the mid-15th century. Moreover, I edited one collection of Chinese essays on Zheng He, the greatest navigator of Ming China, who led a seven larger-scale maritime voyages to the Indian Ocean between 1405 and 1433. Many popular publications even claimed that his fleets also reached the Americas, but actually we have no evidence to prove that claim. Moreover, I led a group of scholars and students together with community activists. We created a website, Victoria's Chinatown, a gateway to the past and the present of Chinese Canadians. I would say probably this is the best website on North American Chinatown. You can find this website by Googling Welcome to Victoria's Chinatown. Welcome to Victoria's Chinatown, and you can find this website. I was also a major researcher for the website Chinese Canadian Artifacts Project. And also, you can use the title to find this website. I worked with dozens of small museums in British Columbia for the creation of this website. Yeah, these are some major works I have done so far.
Yeah, thank you, Dr. Chen, for sharing, especially your research interests and also the community involvement and also some cooperation with the museums. And then for our audience, if you're interested, I will be including those websites that Dr. Chen mentioned in the show notes. So you will be able to access the website from there as well. And so with that, we wanted to sort of, we are interested in knowing how did you start this book project? This is about the Chinese in the North America and also their political activism.
Okay. I first became interested in the subject of this book after I arrived in the University of Hawaii as a doctoral student in 1990, because Sun Yat-sen, the so-called father of Republican China, started the Republican Revolution from Honolulu in 1894. I also became interested in the subject after I began to teach at the University of Victoria in Western Canada in 2002, because Kang Youwei, a major agitator for the first but a failed political reform in modern China in 1898, restarted his political reforms overseas among the worldwide Chinese communities from this Canadian city, Victoria, in 1899. He established the Chinese Empire Reform Association, or the title in Chinese, Bao Huang Hui, or the Society to Protect the Emperor in Victoria in July 1899. And this organization later developed more than 200 branches among the Chinese communities in North America, South America, Asia, Australia, and even Africa, and it became the truly first global Chinese political party, although at the moment declined one decade later. So what really aroused my interest in the Booker Project was my preliminary research on the political assassination of Tang Hualong, a late Qing reformer and an important statesman of early Republican China, in Victoria in 1918. Later, I found that this assassination in Victoria in 1918 was linked with another political murder of a highly influential, famous Chinese journalist in San Francisco in 1915. I was also surprised to find that the first Chinese women's political organization in 1,000 years of Chinese history actually started from Victoria in 1903 and then spread to nearly 1,000 Canadian and American cities. Moreover, Sun Yat-sen won support from the Chinese Freemasons in Victoria in early 1911, and then in other Canadian and American cities, including San Francisco, which helped make him the first provisional president of Republican China in 1912. So all of these discoveries led me to write this book that covers the political history of modern China, Chinese American history, Chinese Canadian history, and the history of the Chinese communities in the Pacific Rim between 1898 and 1918. In connection with the book project, I conducted not only documentary research in many Chinese, Canadian, and American archives and libraries, but also conducted field work in China 5 times in 2009, 2012, 2016, 2018, and 2019, and in many Canadian and American cities and towns in British Columbia, in Montana, in Idaho, in Washington, and in the 3 years in 2012, 2013, and 2016. Yeah.
Thank you for sharing, and specifically the different field works and all the this like a very interesting moment in the modern Chinese history that inspire you to start this book. And before we get to talk about each of those interesting moments that you just mentioned in relation particularly to your chapters, we want to talk about this kind of like a framework for your analysis, and especially you use a network approach. So, can you tell us a little bit about what is network approach and how does this approach can help us better understand overseas Chinese communities?
Okay, network analysis developed as a research approach by Western scholars from the mid-20th century. It originally focused on interpersonal relations among family members, clansmen, friends, native place of fellows, and so on. A leading scholar in network analysis is Dr. Mark Granovetter, a professor in the Department of Sociology at Stanford University. His most famous research is on social networks in job markets. In terms of job hunting strategy, previous studies in network analysis assumed that you and your close friends and relatives would form strong ties or networks, and such a strong ties or strong networks would provide the most crucial help for you to find a job. But Dr. Granovetter's research makes a totally different argument. It reveals that the social networks of close friends and relatives with strong ties are too narrow, and they could give you only the limited and repeated information about job opportunities. In such a small social network, among the people with strong ties, if one person knows one job opportunity, everybody in the same circle will know that. And so that's why he argued the weak ties or the loose networks among colleagues in working units and among members in social organizations would include more numerous and diverse people and would provide a person with a much richer information about many job opportunities through different channels. So this is his classical study. It is most cited in the network analysis in sociology. But my network approach is a little different from the conventional one. My network approach further argues that we should analyze both interpersonal and institutional relations rather than separate them, because our personal relations among family members, friends, classmates, and colleagues are based on institutional arrangements such as marriage, families, clubs, schools, working units, and so on. So thus, I argue that the strength and significance of networks lie in their ability to develop from the interpersonal level to institutional level, to expand through both interpersonal and institutional ties, to bring increasingly different people and organizations into interactions, and to provide interactive dynamics for social and historical changes. This approach is useful for us to study overseas Chinese community, because the Chinese at home and abroad do stress the importance of interpersonal ties, or in Chinese, 关系, most Chinese migrants usually would use the kinship relation among family members or clansmen, the native place of fellowship among people from the same both places for migration to a specific foreign country or foreign city, and for the search of job opportunities in job market. So this is what sociologists call a chain migration. But the Chinese migrants also formed their clans, native place associations, and community organizations for mutual help, for collective protection. For example, in San Francisco, Chinatown, Chinese migrants formed the so-called six companies or the six native place associations from 1850s for mutual help, for self-protection. And then they turned these six so-called six companies or six native and dialect associations into the Chinese Consolidated Benevolent Association, or in Chinese called Zhonghua Huiguan, in the 1880s. From 1898 to 1918, so the period covered by my book, the Chinese reformers and the revolutionaries in North America used both interpersonal and institutional relations to develop their political parties. So network approach became more useful for analysis of such political organizations, including both their interpersonal and institutional relations among the overseas Chinese. So that's why my book adopts this research approach.
Yeah, especially thinking about the personal interaction, but also interpersonal and also institutional ties that these migrants have in different locations and also with their home as well. So with this network approach, and then this book has four different chapters, and let's start with the first one. And first one is particularly about Kang Youwei. And so can you tell us a little bit about Kang Youwei's life and also his activity in China as well as in North American Chinatowns?
Okay. Kang Yue was the first and also the most influential political reformer in modern China. He lived between 1858 and 1927, and he was born to a Cantonese scholar official family in Nanhe County near today's Guangzhou, north of Hong Kong. Starting from 1883, he had started the social reform in his home place. Although the Chinese women at that time had to bind their feet and limit their activities to their home, to their households, Kang Yue refused to bind the feet of his two daughters, and he even formed an anti-food binding association to fight against these sexist customs. But Kang Yue became famous mainly because he promoted the first political reform of Qing government under the leadership of Emperor Guangxu in 1898. Although the reform lasted only for about 100 days, so that's why it was also called the 100 days reform. So although the 1898 political reform was suppressed by conservative faction in the Qing government, and the reforms the Emperor Guangxu was put under house arrest thereafter, Kang Yue was able to flee from China, first to Hong Kong, then to Japan, and then to Canada in 1899. And then he used his reforms of propaganda, starting from Victoria, to mobilize Chinese Canadians into the reform for both China and Chinatowns. With support from Chinese community leaders in Western Canada, he formed the Chinese Empire Reform Association, or in Chinese called Bao Huang Hui, the society to protect the emperor in Victoria on July 20, 1899. So this Reform Association was a popular organization, and it included at least one third of Chinese migrants in Canada by 1905. It was also the first truly global political party of the Chinese across the Pacific Rim, and had more than 200 branches in the world by 1908. It also developed a series of business ventures, such as banks and commercial companies in Hong Kong, New York, and even a railway company in Moscow. Its capital reached about $2 million American dollars by that time. It also led a global Chinese boycott against American goods in protest against the racial discrimination against the Chinese in the United States in 1905. And that boycott forced the American President Roosevelt to order friendly treatment of Chinese passengers by American customs and American immigration authorities. Moreover, in 1903, Kang Yue's second daughter, Kang Tongbi, also came to Canada and launched a women's branch of this reformed association, the Chinese Empire Ladies Reform Association, or in Chinese called Bao Huang Li Hui, or the Women's Society to Protect the Emperor. So this was really the first women's political association in Chinese history, and it later developed more than 10 chapters in Vancouver, Seattle, San Francisco, Los Angeles, Chicago, New York, and Honolulu, and other cities. So it promoted the constitutional reform for women's rights in education and politics, and also rallied the small number of Chinese women in North American Chinatowns for the first time. So this was the first Chinese Women's Political Association, because before that time, before 1903, in Chinese cities like Shanghai, there also appeared women's associations. But the women's association in China, they mainly promote women's education. They were not really political association as the Chinese Empire Ladies Reform Association that started from Victoria in 1903. Okay.
Yeah, as you mentioned, Kang Youwei started as this activist, this kind of intellectual who is leading the reform in China and also expanding that reform to the firstly in Canada, in from Victoria, and then how the Chinese Empire Reform Association grow into more than 200 branches. And also, as you mentioned, specifically also has the Chinese Ladies Association as well. And that is developing more than 10 chapters as well. So with this, to think about his activism, or I should specify reformist activism, and how that reformist activism expanded, not just in Canada, but also in United States and also beyond as well. But with this expansion and around 1909, we started to see there are some decline as well. So this is the focus of your chapter two. Can you tell us a little bit about how and why did the Reformist Association that expanded so quickly, but later on declined?
Okay. The Chinese Empire Reform Association started from Victoria in Western Canada in July 1899, and then it quickly expanded into the United States and other countries across the Pacific Rim for a few reasons. First, Kang Youwei was a Cantonese from Guangdong province, and almost 99% of early Chinese migrants in the so-called New World, ranging from North America, South America, Hawaii to Australia, were Cantonese people from the same province. So Kang Youwei also claimed to be a former advisor to the reformed Emperor Guangxi in the 1898 reform of the Qing government. So that's why he used not only his political prestige, but also his native place of fellowship to contact the Cantonese migrants from Guangdong province to almost all the New World. So that kind of interpersonal relations among Cantonese migrants in the New World certainly helped the expansion of his reformist organization. So that's why most members of his organization were Cantonese migrants. Second, the Kang Youwei's reformist association developed not only among the mostly Cantonese migrants in the so-called New World, but also among the non-Cantonese migrant communities, such as the Chinese communities in Southeast Asia, because in Southeast Asia, most Chinese migrants came from Fujian province on the southeast coast across Taiwan Strait. So they were not Cantonese. Most Chinese migrants in Southeast Asia were not Cantonese. But why they also joined the Kang Youwei's organization? That happened because Kang Youwei used the propaganda for patriotic and a progressive reform of both the China and Chinatowns to attract the Chinese migrants, urged them to struggle for reform and a modernization of their homeland to save not only the reforms the Emperor Guangxi and especially China from foreign invasion, but also to save overseas Chinese themselves from racial discrimination. So that the kind of political propaganda mobilized overseas Chinese migrants to join his reformist association. Because the Kang Youwei's reformist association was called the Society to Protect the Emperor, it made a promise for awards with the stocks or even high official positions to its participants after the successful rescue of the Guangxi Emperor and after success of the reformist cause. And that certainly also attract overseas Chinese migrants. The third reason was probably that the Kang Youwei's Reformist Association did not have stricter requirements for its members. Any Chinese migrants could just sign on the membership rolls of this Reformist Association and become its members. At first, they were not even required to pay any membership fees. So thus, the reforms association was more like a loose social political networks rather than a strict political party. So that was also a reason for its quicker development at first and its quicker collapse later on. However, Communist Reforms Association declined by 1909 for more important reasons. Previous studies always assumed that this Reforms Association in North America was defeated by the Revolutionary Party led by Sun Yat-sen, but my book proves that is not true, because Sun Yat-sen's Revolutionary Association did not really develop in North America until 1909. But by that time, the reforms movement had already declined. One major reason for the decline of the Reforms Association by 1909 was its original Chinese title was called Bao Huanghui, or the Society to Protect the Emperor. But the Guangxi Emperor was murdered by the conservative faction in 1908. And thus, this Reforms Association lost the emperor to be protected. But the more important reason was Kanye and the power structures with overseas Chinese leaders of this association, especially the leaders from Los Angeles and Vancouver, they competed for the control of the business ventures of this association in Hong Kong, Chicago, and Moscow. And that internal strife was a major reason for the decline of this Reforms Association by 1909. So my book has detailed discussion about such an internal strife and its negative impacts on the reforms movement.
Yeah, and specifically, yeah, you mentioned this kind of expansion with this network connection. We have the Native Place Fellowship. Most of the immigrants at that time were from Guangdong, from South China. They are Cantonese migrants, but also expanding to other non-Guangdong migrants, for example, in Southeast Asia, and also how this association sort of welcome all to join them. In the beginning, there's no membership fee requires, but as you mentioned, by 1909, we started to see the decline as the emperors already, their goal is to protect the emperor, but now the emperor already murdered, and we also see the internal divide within the association as well. So as the association declined by 1909, we started to see another political activism, another force of political activism in overseas started to grow and develop. And this is earlier you mentioned Sun Yat-sen's revolutionary activities. So now we will be moving to chapter three, and specifically to think about how Sun Yat-sen and also his revolutionary fellows developed their own political association for the anti-Qing revolution in North America, Chinatown. And also, did their activity overlap with the reformers, or how did they interact with each other?
Previous studies have often stressed the political competitions and struggles between Sun Yat-sen's revolutionary parties and Communist Reforms Associations. But my book confirms that and even reveals how the two political factions used violent assassinations to deal with each other. But my book mainly discusses how Sun Yat-sen's revolutionary parties had interpersonal, institutional, and ideological connections with the Communist Reforms Associations and movements, and how the revolutionary movement benefited from the reforms movement. Sun Yat-sen founded his first anti-Qing revolutionary organization, the Revived Chinese Society, or in Chinese, called Xing Zong Hui in Honolulu in 1894. And he later further established the Revolutionary Alliance, or in Chinese, called Tong Meng Hui in Japan in 1905. His Revived Chinese Society successfully developed two branches in San Francisco, the first one in 1896 and the second one in 1904. But these two branches of his revolutionary organization included only a few Chinese Christians and was short-lived. His revolutionary alliance first expanded to San Francisco and it developed a youth study society, or in Chinese called a Shaolin Xuesheng, in July 1909. But the earliest trans-Pacific expansion of this revolution alliance from East Asia to North America relied on the help of a son from a reformed family in Victoria. Sun Yat-sen then arrived in North America near the end of 1909, and he established the first American branch of the Revolution Alliance in New York. But this first American branch of his Revolution Alliance was formed in the home of two former reformist leaders, and they also included the other former reformers as its major leaders. In fact, Sun Yat-sen promoted the anti-Qing revolution movement mainly through the Chinese Freemasons or the Triad Society in Cantonese called Chi Kung Tong, in North America, in Mandarin called Zi Gong Tang. As my book shows, he at first followed the reformers to join the Triad Society in Honolulu in 1904, and then took over a radical reformers' mission to reform and mobilize this secret society in the United States. But he was not successful until early 1911. It actually was another revolution leader, Feng Ziyu, who successfully mobilized the Chinese Freemasons or the Triad Society first in Canada and then in the United States in 1910 and 1911. So Feng Ziyu greatly helped Sun Yat-sen win the support from this secret society in North America just before the Republican Revolution happened in Central China on October 10th, 1911. But just remember, Feng Ziyu was also from a reformed family in Japan, from Yokohama. And Feng Ziyu himself was a reformer himself before. So thus, the reformed movement actually helped Sun Yat-sen's revolutionary movement in North America. So according to the research by some leading American scholars, even the Republican Revolution in China around 1911 was mainly led by domestic reformers. These domestic reforms became frustrated with the sham reform of the Qing government. They turned to the revolution. So Sun Yat-sen and his revolutionary parties were not a major leading force in the Republican Revolution around 1911. The simple fact is that Sun Yat-sen, when the Republican Revolution started from Central China, from Wuchang on October 10th, 1911, Sun Yat-sen was not in China. He actually was traveling in the United States, in Denver, in Colorado. And after that, even he heard the outbreak of the revolution movement in China, he did not go back. He continued his travel to East Coast of the United States and then went to Europe. He did not actually go back to China until December 25, the Christmas Day of 1911. By that time, the revolution in China already succeeded in southern China. So that's why some leading American scholars believe it was mainly the domestic reformers. They actually were major leading force in the Republican Revolution around 1911. And certainly Sun Yat-sen's party still played a leading role in some places of China, like Shanghai, and Sun Yat-sen's Revolution Party did play a leading role there. But in most provinces of China, the reformers actually were more important in the revolution movement. Although Sun Yat-sen did become the first provisional president of Republican China for some specific reasons.
Yeah, and it's very interesting to know to think about the reformists, their involvement, and to some degree also participation in the revolutionary activities, how they engage and interact with the revolutionary parties and also their project and their action as well. And we have the two different kinds of parties. One is a reformist and one is revolutionary. But now, after 1911, that is the fall of the Qing Dynasty, when the Republican Revolution they eventually succeeded. So, what happened to the Chinese people in the United States, and especially those reformers and revolutionaries after the fall of the Qing Dynasty? What happened to them in China and also in North American Chinatowns?
Many previous studies assume that the reforms the movement basically failed before the 1911 Republican Revolution in China, and the reforms organization totally was defeated and disappeared. But actually, that is not true. After the 1911 Revolution, reforms association did not totally disappear. It still keeps at least 98 branches in Canada and the United States up to 1911. And it had a total of 124 branches among overseas Chinese communities in the world. Leading reformers like Kang Youwei and his chief disciple, Liang Qichao, they were still active in early Republican politics. And their political parties were still influential at home and abroad. But the reformers and their parties mainly worked with the military leaders or the future warlords in their fight against the revolutionary parties under Sun Yat-sen's leadership. But their partnership with ambitious military strongmen or warlords would lead to their political failure. For example, Kang Youwei worked with one senior warlord and tried to restore the last emperor of Qing China to power in 1917. But this imperial restoration lasted only for 12 days, and then Kang Youwei became a notorious politician thereafter. By contrast, Sun Yat-sen became the provisional president of Republic of China only for a short while in early 1912. And he quickly lost the power to the military strongman Yuan Shikai, and then became a political fugitive in Japan again until mid-1916. Sun Yat-sen and his parties did not play major roles in the domestic politics in early Republican period, especially in the two fights against the imperial restoration. Sun Yat-sen finally could defeat his political enemies, including the former Liaoning reformers, mainly because he continuously, passionately built his Chinese Revolutionary Party or the Chinese National League, or in Chinese called Kuomintang, as a strong partisan force. And his party would finally become the ruling party in China in the future and also achieve hegemony among the overseas Chinese communities.
Yeah, to think about what happened after 1911, especially how these different political activities and also their political vision develop and transform, is very interesting. Specifically, to think about the critical changing moment in modern Chinese history. So with that, we talk about the four chapters, and we are just wondering that any materials that didn't get to be included in the book, or anything that you find most unexpected, the surprising material that you encounter in writing this book.
As I said before, I originally became interested in the political assassination of Tan Hua Long in Victoria in 1918. And at first, I tried to write a book, a bestseller on this case, and even took a trip to visit the home place of Tan Hua Long and the home place of assassin in China in 2009. But when I went to field work, at the Library and Archives Canada in Ottawa in 2012. I found that the police investigative files regarding assassination in the archives of the Ministry of Justice of the Canadian government was taken away by somebody. So the archive folder was empty. So I could not find enough, archive information regarding this assassination case. But I found a lot of materials regarding Kang Youwei and Sun Yat-sen in the Library and Archives Canada. That partly is a reason for me to expand the book project from its early focus on Tang Hualong's assassination to the long-term political history of Chinese reform and the revolution in North America from 1898 to 1918. Because this political assassination was just one result of the political struggles between the two political factions. So that's why the detailed discussion about this political assassination became the last section of last chapter of my book.
Yeah, I hope that one day we will be able to restore those missing files, missing information, especially as you mentioned, to think about how those violent action and violent resource, that's assassination during that period of time, and how that kind of shape the Republican China and also the different power struggle, the internal divide within the government as well. And so with that, now finishing this wonderful book, and we're interested to know what you're working on right now and what will be your next project?
In fact, after the publication of my the new book, Trans-Pacific Reform and the Revolution, I have just completed a new book manuscript. And its title is The Trans-Pacific Chinese Diaspora from China to Canada and Beyond, 1788 to 1898. So this book covers not only the early Chinese migration history in Canada, but also in the United States. And many people assume that the larger scale Chinese migration to North America started after the outbreak of the Gold Rush in California. From 1848, and then in British Columbia from 1858. But my new book and manuscript reveals that the Chinese from Fujian province, that is on southeast coast of China near Taiwan. So the people from Fujian province had already migrated to the Philippines. And from there, they further migrated from Manila to Mexico before 1815. But the larger scale of direct migration from China to North America really started from three groups of about 165 Chinese who engaged in the British and American merchants' fur trade in today's Western Canada in 1878 to 79. So my new book basically traces the Chinese history in North America mainly to these three groups of people, including the oldest Chinese, the first Chinese in Hawaii, actually also was a member of this group, and he stayed in Hawaii from 1879. So my new book also discusses how the Cantonese people from Guangdong province expanded their gold mine activities from California to Canada, through the organized migration of Chinese laborers by merchant companies, and how they first helped build the Central Pacific Railroad in the American West in 1863 to 69, and then joined the construction of the Canadian Pacific Railway from 1880 to 1885. They also launched the community reforms from San Francisco to Chinatown to Victoria's Chinatown in the early 1880s. They established their community organizations, such as the Chinese Consolidated Benevolent Association, or Zhonghua Huiguan in San Francisco, in Portland, in Victoria, and used this kind of Western style organization to fight against racial discrimination and to also to fight some internal divides inside the Chinese community. So this book project right now has been completed and is under review by One Press. But apart from that, I also received a 5-year of federal grant from the Social Sciences and Humanity Research Council of Canada to work on the environmental history of China during the later Ice Age from 1400 to 1900. And that will be my major research project in the next few years. Because as you know, the late Ice Age actually was not a favorable period for Chinese history because the weather became unfavorable to agriculture, especially for the economic development of the Chinese agriculture empire. But in face of this kind of unfavorable weather condition and in the more frequent natural disaster like the floods and especially droughts, but China actually developed as one of the most advanced countries with the most advanced agriculture economy in the world up to 1400. And the Chinese population also reached the highest level in this period. So my book tried to explain, why China still could, agricultural economy in China still could develop and even reach the zenith under this kind of unfavorable climatic condition. And hopefully this book could help us to learn historical lessons and experience for us to fight against the unfavorable environmental change today, the global warming. Okay.
Well, both sounds great projects, and then we look forward to reading more of your work in near future. And I want to thank you, Dr. Chen, for being on the show today. I really enjoy our conversation.
You're welcome. And also thank you.
And I also want to thank you, our audience, for staying with us till the end. I hope everyone is taking good care, staying safe. See you guys next time. Goodbye.